So take a few minutes to ensure that your motivation, your reason for being here is an altruistic one, wanting the best, happiness, well-being, liberation from suffering and its causes, and ultimately enlightenment, Buddhahood, for all living beings. So this morning, at the beginning of the meditation session, I was thinking about how we all believe we are very fortunate to be born as a human being and have the precious human life, precious human rebirth, which mainly means we have all the right ideal conditions, external as well as internal, to make contact with the Buddha's teachings, to learn about the Buddha's teachings, and then put them into practice. So this is something I think we all think about every day, or we should. it's kind of a basis for our life as a Buddhist, especially as a monastic. But then I thought, but there are a lot of people in the world who think that we've got it all wrong. You think that their religious or spiritual tradition is superior, is the best, and we are inferior. Buddhism is inferior. And some even go further and think that it's evil, it's the creation of the devil, of Satan, and we're just totally on the wrong path. We're on the path to hell, something like that. So people have all kinds of different ideas, different views, different opinions about things. How do we know who's right and who's wrong? What's true and what's not true? What does exist and what doesn't exist? So according to Buddhism, or at least according to the tradition of Dignaga and Dharmakirti, which is based on the Buddha's teachings, but they developed this whole system of logic and reasoning in which it is said that the criterion for something to be existent is that it has to be known by a valid cognition, a valid mind. So if there's at least one valid mind or reliable mind or prime mind, whatever you want to call it, that special type of mind, if there's at least one of those minds that knows an object correctly, incontrovertibly, non-erroneously, then that means that object exists. That object is something real, something true, something existent. So that's what we're looking at here in this topic, or what we have been looking at for the last couple of weeks, this topic of valid minds, valid cognizers, what type of minds are valid and totally reliable, and what type of minds are not totally reliable. Because that's really, really important, to be able to know for sure what does exist and what doesn't exist, what's correct, what's false, what's true, what's wrong. So, you know, a lot of people think that, oh, if something is written in a book that's been around for thousands of years, and many people believe it's a holy book, the word of some holy being, then it's true and it cannot be questioned, it cannot be doubted. Whatever that book says is true. So that's their basis for knowing what's true and what's not true. But now, Buddha said, well, you can't just believe what is written in a book. You can't just believe something, even if there are millions of people in the world who believe that, that isn't enough to make something true. Okay? So he kind of listed these various criteria for, you know, why to believe something and why not to believe something. But the most important thing is having a valid mind, having a totally correct mind, seeing that object, understanding that object, knowing that object. So this is a difficult subject. It's not easy. But it's good at least to have the chance to learn about it and make effort to understand it. So we've been going through these seven different types of minds or awarenesses, some of which are valid and reliable and some of which are not. And we have all of these in our mind at different times. So the point of looking at this, learning about this, is so that we can become more clear about which type of consciousness or mind that's coming up in us, which ones are correct and reliable and which ones are not. So out of the seven types of awareness, we've covered the first four, and we have three left, so hopefully we'll be able to finish them tonight. This is the last night. But just one thing before we start. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about bodhicitta and what type of mind that is, and we thought it's probably conceptual mind, at least in ordinary beings, not Buddhas. So I checked with this friend of mine. His name is Phuntsok, Venerable Phuntsok. He's a monk in Ganden Monastery, and he's been studying many years. So he said, yes, it's true that in the minds of sentient beings, that means non-Buddhas, bodhicitta is conceptual. So that seems to include even high bodhisattvas, even very high bodhisattvas. It's still conceptual rather than non-conceptual. And as for the mind of a Buddha, there's different opinions. This is something we already looked at. Some say that the Buddha does have bodhicitta. Some say the Buddha doesn't have bodhicitta. So there's different opinions. And he said the texts are not so clear on this point. But anyway, I tend to go with the idea that the Buddha does have bodhicitta. I like that. I think the only way to know for sure is to find a Buddha and ask, do you have bodhicitta in your mind? Otherwise, arguing about this, you know, we can't come to any decision. No, in the mind of a Buddha, if a Buddha does, I think so. I think a Buddha has bodhicitta. But the bodhicitta in the mind of a Buddha would be non-conceptual because a Buddha has no conceptions. Every state of mind of a Buddha is direct perception. But those who are not Buddhas, the term sentient being, you know, refers to anyone who's not a Buddha. So even arhats, even high-level bodhisattvas are still sentient beings. So sentient beings means non-Buddhas. So sentient beings, when they have bodhicitta, it's conceptual. Okay, so the next of the seven types of awareness that we'll look at it's number five, and it has a long name. Awarenesses to which the object appears but is not ascertained. And a short kind of a nickname for that is inattentive perception. That's not really a proper translation, but it's more of a description for this type of mind. And so the definition, did you find it in your notes? Definition? It's a knower to which the specifically characterized phenomenon, which is its object of engagement, clearly appears, but which is unable to induce ascertainment with respect to it. So we'll go through the words in that definition to understand what they're talking about. So it's a knower, it's a mind. And then there's this term, specifically characterized phenomenon, which has always kind of baffled me, partly because it just sounds so complicated. But it's really just another term for impermanent phenomena. It's like a synonym of impermanent phenomena. And I think the reason, I was reading up on this, the reason it's called by this term, specifically characterized, is because when an impermanent phenomena, for example, this table, or any impermanent phenomena, when the table appears to our mind, when we see it, appears to us and we see it, according to this school, the sutra followers, Sutrandika, it appears along with all of its specific characteristics, including its impermanence. So you may have heard that before, that when impermanent phenomena appear to us, their impermanence appears along with everything else, their shape, color. And I'm not sure, it might even be the atoms, the particles of that object. These actually, have you heard that before? They actually appear to us, but that doesn't mean that we actually perceive them, but they do appear. Definitely the impermanence of things does appear to us, but if we're still ordinary beings who haven't yet realized impermanence, we can't get it. We don't get it, but it does appear to us. So I think because all the specific characteristics, all the characteristics of an object, an impermanent object, appear, that's why it's called specifically characterized. Anyway, so if that's too complicated, you can just think of it as an impermanent object. So this type of mind is always perception. It's always non-conceptual. It's never conception. So it's any of the six types of direct perception. And then object of engagement. We had that before. That means the main object that the mind is dealing with. So when we're looking at the table is the object of engagement. When we're looking at upekkha, upekkha is the object of engagement. So whatever it is that we are engaging with, the mind is dealing with, is the object of engagement. Then there's the term clearly appears. Clearly appears means that it directly appears, not through a mental image, like with conception. So we've seen how when we have a non-conceptual mind, a direct perceiver, contacts the object directly or nakedly rather than through this sort of film of a mental image. Okay, so the mind and the object kind of contact each other directly. So the object clearly appears, but this mind is not able to induce ascertainment with respect to it. So this expression, ascertainment, means certainty, meaning that if, like in a, if we have a valid direct perception, like looking at the table, we look at the table, and if it's a valid eye consciousness seeing the table, then afterwards we are certain that we saw the table. We have no doubt about it. Maybe another example is this afternoon I was walking up in the meadow, and I saw a snake. And I'm sure that I saw a snake. You know, somebody tries to talk me out of it and said, no, it was a piece of rope or it was a piece of a hose or something. It wasn't a snake. I would say, no, I'm sure it was a snake. Definitely. I saw it very clearly with my eyes. I saw it had stripes on it, black and light yellow, kind of. What kind of snake is that? Huh? Garter snake. So they're not harmful, right? Are there any harmful snakes here? Okay, good. Anyway, I didn't feel scared. I just thought he looked really pretty. It was really pretty. And I said some mantras for it. But anyway, So now I can sit here and say to you, I definitely saw a snake this afternoon. I'm absolutely certain. I have no doubt about it. So that's the meaning of ascertainment. Ascertainment means I'm sure. I'm completely sure about what I saw, what I experienced. Okay. So when we have a valid direct perception, a reliable direct perception, afterwards we are completely sure about what we saw or heard or smelled or whatever. Okay, no doubt about it. Now, this type of mind is not able to bring about that kind of mind. And it happens because we're not really paying attention. This happens all the time. So I give a little bit further down. I'll just jump there. I give an example. Let's say you're at a concert. I mean, now we are monastics and we don't go to concerts, but in the past we probably did. So if somebody is at a concert and let's say there's, you know, orchestra playing, band playing, whatever, and the music is really wonderful and we're just totally absorbed in the sound of the music. And maybe at the back of the stage, there's a curtain. And if we have our eyes open, we're looking at the curtain, okay? But we're not really attentive. We're not really paying full attention to it because our attention is directed at the music. So afterwards, if somebody asks us, what color was the curtain? We wouldn't be able to say. Have you ever had that experience? This happens a lot, yeah? So that's an example of this type of mind. There is a perception. It could be of a visual object or a sound or a smell or a taste or a physical feeling. But because our attention is directed elsewhere, we're not fully attentive to that perception. And so afterwards, we're not sure what we saw, what we heard. Yeah? So that's the meaning of this type of mind. So we have a lot of these, in fact, especially I was thinking when we're busy, yeah, when you're busy doing many things and there may be a lot of things going on around you, especially in a city, you know, and there's just so much happening all the time. And it's just not possible. It's actually impossible to register each and every sound and sight and smell, right? So, unless they say if you're an Arya, if you're somebody who's realized emptiness, if you're that level of being, then you don't have any more of these because you're totally aware of everything that happens. But up until that point, so much of our perceptions just happen without full awareness, and then we can't remember afterwards. We can't be sure afterwards what we saw and so on. Okay, so in simple terms then, this type of mind is non-conceptual, it's perception, and its object is an impermanent phenomena. And that impermanent phenomena clearly appears, but the mind, because it's not paying complete attention, it's kind of inattentive to that object, then it's not able to lead to certainty about it later. But it's interesting, if you look at the paragraph under the bullet points, so it says, this type of mind is always non-conceptual, i.e. perception, never conception. In fact, it is a direct perceiver. So this kind of mind is actually considered a direct perceiver, which we looked at before. And what that means is it's always non-mistaken. It's not mistaken about its object. It's non-mistaken. So the object does appear to this mind, for example, an eye consciousness seeing green. However, the mind doesn't realize it or ascertain it, doesn't fully grasp it, and therefore it's not able to induce an ascertaining consciousness. An ascertaining consciousness is a conceptual mind, a memory that arises later and knows, is certain, I saw that or I heard that. So this kind of mind can't lead to that. So it's never a prime cognition or a valid cognition. It can never be that type of mind. It's never incontrovertible. Okay, then in the next paragraph I give some different examples, like the being at the concert, seeing the curtain but not recognizing what color it is. Actually, it said the eye consciousness does know, it does perceive the color of the curtain. But because you're not paying full attention, you can't remember, you can't be sure afterwards. Another example is if you're absorbed in watching a movie on TV, or if you're reading a book or having, you know, a conversation with somebody and you're really absorbed in that, and then someone says, dinner is ready. So you do have a non-mistaken ear consciousness, hearing the sound of this person's voice, but because your attention is focused on the movie or whatever, you don't pay full attention to what is being said, and therefore you don't fully realize it. And you'll probably have to say, what was that you said? Please repeat that. Okay. So does that sound familiar? So it could be with any of our six senses. Smell, taste. Yeah, like if we're eating food, but thinking about something or, you know, paying attention to something else, we might not be fully aware of what we're tasting. Or bodily feelings as well. Like when you're really caught up in your work and you might be hungry or your stomach is, you know, gurgling, growling and asking for food, but you just kind of don't pay attention to that. Or your shoulders are getting kind of tight and tense and it's time to take a break, but you're not fully aware of that. Okay, so then the next part says, to understand this more clearly, let's review the meaning of the terms to realize and non-mistaken. Because this mind is said to be non-mistaken, however, it doesn't realize its object. That's a little tricky. So for a mind to realize its object means that it is able to, one, lead to a correct ascertainment of the object, i.e. later one can remember correctly and precisely what one saw, heard, and so forth, and two, eliminate superimpositions or misconceptions about it. For example, knowing that the color of the curtain was green and not red. So that's what it means to realize. And a valid cognizer, a valid mind, always realizes its object. So it always leads to a correct ascertainment and eliminates superimpositions. But this type of mind, neither of these two things occur for this type of mind. So it doesn't realize its object. And then the term non-mistaken, we had that before. Non-mistaken means the mind isn't mistaken with regard to its appearing object. So the appearing object, in the case of a direct perception, seeing, hearing, smelling, and so forth, the appearing object is actually the same as the object of engagement. Whatever it is the mind is engaging with, a table, a curtain, a cat, whatever, that is also the appearing object. But in the case of a conception, the appearing object is what? What's the appearing object?
The conception.
The mental, yeah, sometimes it's called mental image or meaning generality or, I don't know, what is Venerable Chodron to call it?
Conceptual
appearance, okay. That's a descriptive term, but the literal term in Tibetan, it's meaning generality. But it's hard to make sense of that. So yeah, it's just this image that appears to the mind. It's like an internal image appearing to the mind. For example, when we close our eyes and think, if you think about your bed, you might be wanting to go to bed soon. So if you think about your bed, you can get a mental image of your bed or of a person, someone you care about. Okay, or when we meditate on the Buddha, we have a mental image of the Buddha. So those are mental images or conceptual images. And that's the appearing object for conception. But in the case of non-conceptual mind, seeing, hearing, smelling, and so forth, the appearing object is the actual object that we're looking at or listening to, and so on. A mistaken mind would be one that is mistaken with its appearing object. It's making some mistake with the appearing object. Non-mistaken means it's not making a mistake with the appearing object. So we've looked before at examples of mistaken minds. So non-conceptual minds that are mistaken would be, for example, seeing a mirage as water. So if you see the shimmering appearance on the surface of the desert or other kinds of surfaces, like a parking lot. I've seen it also in parking lots. And it looks like water, and you could really swear there's water over there, because that's what it appears to your eyes. So seeing that and thinking there's water. You don't even have to think there's water, even with the eye consciousness. The eye consciousness can be mistaken. Seeing water when there isn't water. And the other examples, seeing rabbit's horns, seeing ears as horns, hearing an echo and thinking it's an actual voice, an actual person. So those are non-conceptual minds that are mistaken. So this means that there's an error, a mistake with regard to what appears. Something appears and the mind believes in that appearance, buys into that appearance, is, you know, confused about that appearance. So that's the meaning of a non-mistaken mind. Sorry, a mistaken mind. But in the case, this type of mind, in the case of an awareness to which the object appears but is not ascertained, the mind is not mistaken to its appearing object. So the green color of the curtain or the sound of the person's voice. So they do appear and the mind does perceive them correctly, but because of a lack of attention, you didn't fully realize, there was a lack of realizing what that object was. Does that make sense? On the other hand, if you did mistakenly perceive the object, for example, if the curtain was, it's green, but you thought it was red, or a voice, you know, somebody talked to you and you thought it was a cat meowing, but it was actually a human voice. So if you actually do see the object in a mistaken way, then it would be a wrong perception. We haven't yet come to wrong consciousness. That's the last on the list. But just below, I made this chart to show the difference between mistaken and wrong. because this can be a little confusing. The terms sound similar, mistaken and wrong. But there are different terms in Tibetan, and they do have different meanings. And one little bit confusing thing is, I think some books, I think, for example, Geshe Rabdon's book translates the terms in the opposite way. So that's really confusing. So that's why it's good to know the Tibetan term so that you can figure out what they're talking about. So the term for mistaken in Tibetan is trul, if you're interested. And the word for wrong is lok. So those are written out there if you want to check them. Okay, so so in this chart then, the first row explains what does it mean? What do these two different minds mean? So mistaken consciousness, a mistaken consciousness is a mind that is mistaken with regard to its appearing object, what appears to it. Whereas a wrong consciousness is a mind that is mistaken with regard to its object of engagement, the object the mind is actually involved with. So we looked at these two different kinds of objects before, appearing object, object of engagement. Sometimes they are the same. In the case of a perception, the appearing object and the object of engagement are the same thing. They're not different. But in the case of a conceptual mind, a thought, they are different. The object of engagement is what you're thinking about. For example, if you're thinking about your bed, your bedroom, that's the object of engagement. But what is appearing, the appearing object to that mind, is this mental image or conceptual image, just like an image inside your mind, an image of your bed, of your bedroom, or whatever it is you're thinking about. It's not the actual object. It's just an image of the object rather than the actual object. Because you can be sitting here in Ananda Hall thinking about your bed over in Gotami or down in Shanti Cabin, wherever your bed is. And so we're not actually seeing it. It's not right in front of us. We can't see it, but we can think of it via this mental image or conceptual image. Okay. So in the case of a conception, the appearing object and the object of engagement aren't the same. One is an actual object. The object of engagement is an actual object. The appearing object is a mental image or a conceptual image of it, just an image. So that's a general meaning of those two, mistaken consciousness and wrong consciousness. Okay, so now in the next row is perception. So in the case of a perception or a non-conceptual mind, some examples of mistaken consciousnesses would be seeing a mirage as water, seeing a reflection of a face in a mirror as a real face. That's another example they often give in the texts. Have you ever had that experience? Seeing something in a mirror and thinking it's an actual thing? One time I walked into a restaurant, and I'd never been there before, and I thought, wow, this is really big. And then after a few minutes, I realized one whole wall was covered with mirrors, and the mirrors were just reflecting what was on this side of the restaurant, so it looked like it was twice as big as it really was. Yeah? So sometimes you may have that kind of experience of seeing reflections but thinking they are real things. And then rabbit's ears, that's a wonderful Tibetan example. Another example, phantom limbs sensations. I've heard about that, like a person might lose one part of their body, like the whole arm, for example, but they still feel it. They actually have sensations as if they have a real arm, a real hand there. That's really interesting. So I thought, that's an example of a mistaken consciousness because there's no hand there, but they're feeling a hand, right? So I don't know if that's a correct example, but that's like that would be an example of a mistaken tactile consciousness. So those are examples of mistaken consciousnesses that are perceptual. And then wrong consciousnesses, next column over. Any perception that is mistaken is also wrong. Okay, if it's a perception and it's mistaken, it's also wrong because the appearing object and the object of engagement are of a perception are the same. So if a perception is mistaken to its appearing object, it's also mistaken to its object of engagement. Does that make sense? This is only for Sutrantika, though, not Mahayana schools. But okay, next down, conception. Okay, all conceptual consciousnesses are mistaken because a mental image or conceptual image of the object appears as if it's the actual object. So when we're thinking about our bedroom or our bed, there's a mental image of that object, the bed, and the mind, that thought, that conceptual mind, isn't able to distinguish that it is just a mental image, a conceptual image, and thinks it's the real thing. That sounds kind of strange, doesn't it?
When I'm thinking about my bed, I know that it's an image in my head.
Yeah.
If I remember my mother's face, I know that it's just a memory.
Yeah. But when I think about how our mind can get emotional when we think of things, right? If you think of your mother's face, you can have some emotion coming up as if it's really her, right? So that's how I think of it. That's how I understand this point. That, and also when we fantasize or daydream or remember, you know, have memories of things that happened in the past, we can get really emotional about that, either sad or angry or happy or, yeah? Has that happened to you? So I think that, to me, that's the indication that when the mind is dealing with this conceptual image, it deals with it as if it's the actual thing. So another mind, I think another mind can step back and say, oh, this is just a fantasy, this is just a memory, this is just thought, it's not really true. Another mind can say that, but that mind itself, the mind that's thinking of that object, that's how I understand it, that is not able to know, is not able to tell that it's only a mental image and not the actual thing. But you're free to doubt that if you want. It's just what it says in the text. This is what the texts all say. But sometimes, yeah, mental images can be really, really powerful too, really strong. Really bring up strong emotions. Also, when we're practicing, we visualize deities, Vajrasattva or Buddha or Tara or whatever, you know. And if you really focus strongly on that image, it appears clearly, you can get really, you can even get realizations, I think, on that basis. Okay, so this is what it says in these texts, that conceptual consciousness are always mistaken because they think that this image is the actual object. But then, with wrong consciousnesses, okay? So it says, although all conceptions are mistaken, not all are wrong. So examples of wrong conceptions would be thinking that sound is permanent when in fact it's impermanent, thinking a mirage is water, thinking the earth is flat, and so on. So these are wrong conceptions. Also, ignorance. Thinking we have a real I, real inherently existing I, and others are inherently existing, and so on. And also all of our disturbing emotions. When we're angry at somebody and we hate that person, we see that person as completely horrible and bad and worthless or whatever, that's also a wrong conception. We're not seeing that person in a correct way. We're seeing them in a mistaken way, in a distorted way. Same with attachment, jealousy. So all the disturbing emotions are actually wrong conceptions, seeing their object mistakenly. Okay, so some conceptions are wrong, but not all. So it says, if a conception correctly realizes its object of engagement, for example, if we know that sound is impermanent, or we know that a mirage is a mirage and not water, or we know that the reflection in the mirror is only a reflection and not a real whatever, then that would not be a wrong conception. It's a correct one. So then I made this little drawing to show the relationship between mistaken consciousnesses and wrong consciousnesses. So I think this means three possibilities, right? There's three possibilities. Okay, so could someone give me an example of something which is both? Both mistaken and wrong.
Seeing a rabbit in the shadow of a moon.
Seeing a rabbit
in the shadow of the moon.
You mean looking at the moon and thinking there's a rabbit there.
Right, because you see there's some shadows up there. And
yeah, thinking like it's a real rabbit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose so. It's an unusual one. Yeah, I don't know. India and Tibet, they see the rabbit. They call the moon rabbit bearer. There's actually a story behind that. Have you heard the story? It's one of the Jataka tales. The Jataka tales are stories of the Buddha's previous lives when he was a bodhisattva. So once upon a time, as a bodhisattva, he was a rabbit. He was a bodhisattva rabbit living in the forest. And he was very good-hearted and pure and generous and kind and got along with all the other animals and so on and so forth. And there was some kind of meditator, ascetic living in the forest, and I think he was just living on, you know, nuts and berries, and I don't remember now the exact story, but there was something like he was really like starving. He was unable to find any food to eat, and so the animals were really concerned about him and were discussing among themselves what to do, you know, how to help this meditator. And so some of them went off to get nuts and berries and so on. But the rabbit thought, I will offer myself, and jumped into the fire. I may be getting some of these details wrong, but he actually, you know, jumped into the fire to provide meat for this meditator. So this was such a noble, generous act that one of the gods, one of the devas, took the rabbit and put him up in the moon so that everybody could see this rabbit and, you know, know something like that. Mm-hmm. Sorry if I got all the details wrong, but there is actually a story behind this rabbit in the moon as opposed to a man in the moon. Okay, so yeah, if you look up at the moon and you think there's a rabbit there, I think that would be mistaken and wrong.
I guess this would be a non-conceptual one. I don't know why this happened, but I'd be washing my hands before I went to bed with really hot water, and then I would turn on the cold water to like rinse my toothbrush or something, and my hands would be under it, and my hands would feel like they were like burning hot. Like I knew the water was cold because I had the hot water off, and it was just cold. But the sensation, you know, was hot. It happened like 3 or 4 times. And so what's on my skin is cold water, but what I'm perceiving is hot.
Yeah, there's probably some explanation for that.
Yeah, I don't know. It didn't matter.
Yeah. I was trying to think of some similar experience, like when you're outside and your hands get really, really cold in the, you know, it's sub-zero temperatures, and then you come inside and put them by the fire and they can be...
Pins and needles.
Yeah, yeah. Very painful. I don't know if it's a similar kind of thing.
The thing that's kind of also non-conceptual is like when I plow the snow this winter, if I plowed for a lot of hours, then when I would get off the tractor and just be sitting or lying down, I would feel like I was moving, but I wasn't.
Yeah. That can happen too with when you're doing physical exercises for a while and then you stop and, Yeah. You're still moving, yeah.
Is it also like I have a dream object, I see an object of desire, and then I'm really engaged in my dream with wanting that object, for example? Would that be then also mistaken and wrong?
Yeah, we had some discussion about dreams, and it seems that some scholars say that they are mental direct perceivers. And they're definitely wrong consciousnesses. Some say that they are conceptual, but either way, they would be wrong consciousnesses, because if you see the object, and it's just a dream object, it's not a real object, but you believe it's real and you're getting caught up as if it is real. Yeah, that would be wrong consciousness and mistaken consciousness. What about a mistaken consciousness that's not a wrong consciousness?
The subject in an inferential cognizer realizing the subtle impermanence of a person.
Yes. Very good.
The subject in inferential cognizer realizing the subtle impermanence of a person.
Any conception. We can take any conception, and this one, or even just a thought about our bedroom. So it's because every conception, every thought is mistaken, but not necessarily wrong. Okay? So just sitting here and thinking about your mom, or thinking about your bed, or thinking about ice cream, or what you're going to do tomorrow, these are thought consciousnesses. They're mistaken, but they're not wrong, unless you're really seeing the object in a distorted way. Well, that's what I was explaining. Well, it's complicated because they say when we have a thought, when we're thinking about something, like if you're thinking about your mother, she's off in Ohio, you're here, so she's not right in front of you. You're not seeing her, you're thinking about her. So when you're thinking about your mother, there's an image of her in your mind. It's like an image, okay? So it said that that kind of mind, it's a thought rather than a perception, it sees this image as if it's the real thing, as if it's really your mother. And that's a mistake, because the image of your mother is not your mother. It's only an image of your mother. But the conceptual mind isn't able to recognize that. So that's a mistake. It's not like the whole mind is wrong and mistaken, but there's just this element of error, element of mistake in that mind. This may seem a bit picky, but it's important when we come to Madhyamika, and you probably already heard this before, the Madhyamika Prasangika. So they say that every single mind, every single consciousness of every single sentient being, that means everybody who's not a Buddha, every single one of our consciousnesses is mistaken. Mistaken, not wrong. Because there's always the appearance of things as truly existing, inherently existing. If I look at Venerable Yeshe, she appears inherently existing, but she's not. So inherently existing Venerable Yeshe is totally non-existent, doesn't exist at all. But my mind isn't able to recognize that. So there's always this element of mistake with every single one of our minds, with only one exception. The exception is the direct realization of emptiness. So only when a sentient being has the direct realization of emptiness and they're sitting there meditating on emptiness, at that point in time, the only thing that appears is emptiness. But there's not the slightest trace of inherent existence appearing. But every other mind that we have, even up to 10th, you know, just before Buddhahood, there's this appearance of things as inherently existing, and the mind buys into that, believes in that. So all of our minds are mistaken, perceptions, conceptions, every single one of our mind is mistaken, but doesn't mean it's wrong. So if I see Venerable Yeshe and I know that's Venerable Yeshe and not Santa Claus or the Dalai Lama or whatever, then that's not a wrong consciousness. It's mistaken but not wrong. But if I thought she was the Dalai Lama, if I thought that was the Dalai Lama sitting there, that would be wrong, wrong perception, wrong consciousness. So when it comes to studying emptiness, Majjhimika, it is important to understand the difference between those terms, mistaken and wrong. Does that make sense? They're not necessarily the same. They could be. One mind could be both mistaken and wrong, but it's also possible that the mind is only mistaken but not wrong. And the meanings of these terms, mistaken and wrong, have specific meanings. So that's why I was kind of spending time on this, focusing on this. Okay, is there any example of a wrong consciousness that is not a mistaken consciousness? Impossible. So that's why wrong consciousness is the inner circle. All wrong consciousnesses are also mistaken, but there are mistaken consciousnesses that are not wrong. And of course, there's things which are neither. For example, a table. Or direct realization of emptiness. So that would neither be mistaken nor wrong. Okay, better get going here. Okay, let's move down. There's a paragraph that starts, another way that one could have an awareness to which the object appears but is not ascertained would be when the duration of the experience is too short to be noticed. Examples, the mental direct perceivers that occur in between a sense direct perceiver of an object and a conception thinking of that object. So we've talked about that before. There's this really brief moment of a mental direct perception following a sense direct perception, and it's too short to notice. So that's also this type of mind. Another example, a subliminal image flashed on a TV screen. Christina brought that up one night. So, yeah. I guess it does register. Yeah, they have done studies on that. Something is registered, but afterwards we don't have any memory of it. We couldn't talk about it or describe it. So it's like it happens. I think this would be an example of that because it's just too short for us to notice. Yeah. Okay, next paragraph. There are three types of awarenesses to which the object appears but is not ascertained. Sense, mental, and self-knowing direct perceivers. So sense would be like the eye consciousness seeing the color of the curtain but not remembering it afterwards. Mental, an example would be that mental direct perceiver that happens after the eye consciousness. And self-knowing would be if you have a self-knowing direct perceiver that is looking at another mind, which is this type of mind, then that would also be inattentive. I like to say inattentive perception. It's so much easier than this long, this long name. But yogic direct perceivers are never this type of mind. They always realize their objects. So they are always fully attentive and fully perceiving, realizing their objects and being able to remember afterwards. Okay, next paragraph says, some scholars, for example, Lama Tsongkhapa, say that it is possible to have all five sense perceptions at the same time. An example is if you go to the movies, you're sitting there looking at the movie, listening to the sounds, voices, music, and so on. Maybe you're eating popcorn, so you have the taste of the popcorn, the smell of the popcorn. And maybe if you're with a friend, maybe you're kind of, you know, close to your friend, or you're just feeling the seat. Maybe it's too hard or too soft or whatever. So you can have all five at the same time. However, at any given moment, only one of the five can realize its object. The remaining four would be this type of mind, awarenesses to which the object appears but is not ascertained. So only one can be attentive at a time. It's interesting, in the Theravada tradition, I just checked this with Bhikkhu Bodhi, they say that you can only have one mind at a time, but they happen so fast, they actually say billions in a second. I don't know who's counting, but they're so fast that they can seem simultaneous. They may appear as if they're happening at the same time, but it really is only one at a time. So there are different points of view about this. But Lama Tsongkhapa does say all five can happen at the same time.
So if only one of them can realize its object at a time, that must be happening really fast, just like the Theravadins are describing, though, because I could feel like I'm experiencing, you know, seeing a flash and hearing a bang at the same time, you know.
So well, they say that in order to realize an object, it's necessary for there to be several moments of the same type of perception. If it's only one tiny brief moment, that wouldn't be enough to actually realize the object. So it would have to be at least, I don't know what if there's a figure, but at least four or five in a row of looking at that same object or hearing that sound to actually realize it. So just one tiny, tiny moment of an object, of perceiving an object, wouldn't be enough to realize it.
But how short are those moments?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, in our tradition, I think they say, finger snap divided into 65 parts. There's a certain term for that. And so 1/65th of a finger snap is, I think, the length of time for each moment of mind. So several of those short moments would be required of focusing on the same object to be able to actually realize it.
But you could have several of those of several different consciousnesses within that short amount of time, enough to see a flash and hear a bang all at once. Feels like all at once, because of 60th of a finger snap is so brief.
That's pretty short. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just saying what they say in the text. But I guess if we really develop our mindfulness, our awareness, being aware of our experiences moment by moment by moment, then one does become more and more aware of what is happening, and maybe things appear as if they're slowing down. I think the mind will probably switch from one thing to another. So maybe for a few moments you're looking at something, and then the next few moments hearing something. And because these are very, very short periods of time, it can seem as if they're simultaneous. But yeah. Okay, next one. Number six. So this I sent yesterday, part four. Okay, so this one is called Doubting Consciousness, or just doubt. And the definition is a knower which by its own power has qualms in two directions. So this type of mind is always conceptual, it's not perception. And it's distinguished by being uncertain, indecisive, or two-pointed. Two-pointed means that the mind wavers between two alternatives. For example, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. But I was thinking that maybe there could be more than two alternatives. Like when you come to a roundabout and there's four or five different roads going off, which one should I take? But I think the point is at least two. You know, there's at least two alternatives, and there could be more than two. Therefore, it is controvertible, not incontrovertible, meaning it's fallible, not infallible, and it doesn't realize its object. It's not strong enough to really realize its object. So doubt is a mental factor. I don't know if some of you have had the chance to study minds and mental factors. Some of you have, some of you haven't, maybe. Yeah. So this is one way of dividing mind. If we take minds, all the different types of minds, they can be divided into primary minds or main minds and mental factors. And they always go together. Like every instant, every mind, every experience that we have is like a package consisting of one main mind, which could be any of the six, seeing, hearing, and so forth, and then a number of mental factors. And the mental factors have different functions, different roles that they play. Feeling, for example, that's the most famous, probably. Famous mental factor is always there in every moment of our mind, every moment of experience, and it experiences the object as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. So that's one example of a mental factor. So doubt is another type of mental factor. It's not always there, but when it is there in the mind, then it causes the whole package, the whole mind, the main mind. In this case, it would have to be a mental consciousness, not a sense consciousness. And any other mental factors that are there, a feeling, a discrimination, they all take on this indecisiveness. They all become indecisive and doubtful. And this is due to the influence of doubt. So it's just like when we put a drop of red dye, red food coloring, into a glass of water, then the whole... all the molecules of the water become red because of that one drop of red dye. So in a similar way, if doubt is in the mind for however long, it causes the whole mind, main mind and mental, all the other mental factors, to take on that character of being undecisive and wavering. And that's why the definition says, by its own power, knower which by its own power has qualms in two directions. So doubt has this factor of wavering. It wavers, it's indecisive, by its own power, its own nature. But the other parts of the mind, the main mind and the other mental factors that are together with it in the same package, they also waver, but not by their own power. It's due to the power or influence of doubt.
Would that be true for other mental factors, that you would use that same kind of mode of operation or explanation by their power, they're impacting the mind this way and all the other things are going along?
So anger, for example, anger is also a mental factor. So if anger is present, then... the main mind, there's always a main mind together with it, and any other mental factor in that assembly, they all take on the character of anger. They all are influenced by anger. They become non-virtuous. They become angry.
So, but it has to then be which one is strong, because some say... I'm just thinking that some of your mental factors, you have a number going on at once, and so they couldn't all, if they're all competing, you know.
Well, it's not possible to have mental factors that are opposite to each other present at the same time. You probably heard that. Like they say, when there's anger, it's not possible at the same time, at the same moment, towards the same object, to have love. Those two are just opposites. So you can only have one of those at a time. So, but together with anger, I don't know what other mental factors. I mean, there would always be a feeling. Feeling is definitely there. And it's probably an unpleasant feeling. Because when we're angry at a person or an object, you know, there's an unpleasant feeling about that person. So it's probably an unpleasant feeling.
I guess what I'm thinking, I can give an example of something that makes me say attention is always there too. But sometimes when I have anger, years ago I realized that one of the things I did to work with it, I think I learned this before I became a Buddhist, and just carried it over. Like I might go out in the woods and I might lay down on the grass and I might just stare at a piece of grass and make my attention go to that so that the attention would overpower that. Not like I wasn't aware, like I was trying to suppress it. I was just trying to steady my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering how do you, since you have different mental factors there, it seems like the intensity of one would make, not just the duration, but better. I don't know. Like I'm going back to what Jeffrey said about the flashlight. It was like what you said with the package. There's a whole package. He described this as like flash lights shining into a box. They're all mixed together to illuminate it. But I got the distinct impression from that that the one that was the strongest would be bleeding into the others, like what you're saying here.
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Probably. I mean, anger is a very powerful mental factor. So if that's there, that would probably overpower anything else and color them. Whereas other mental factors might be more kind of neutral or not so powerful. So I don't know. I haven't come across, I mean, when they teach the mental factors, they don't go into such depth with them. You just kind of define each one, and but how they actually, you know, affect each other and so on is.
I think it kind of interests me because one time I read, if I remember this right, that in one tenet system, might have been by Bhaskara, they say something like that all the virtuous mental factors are there at once. You know what I mean? And so I kind of, when I read that, I thought, well, how great is that? Pick the one that you have the most facility with and make it strong so that you can get all the other ones to come along. You know, it seemed like a good idea.
Yeah, but I don't think the other schools agree with it.
Yeah, they're probably right.
It sounds good. Yeah, I think, I can't remember how many virtuous mental factors, 10? I think it's 10. No, in the Vaibhashika school, they have a different number. But yeah, they say if one is there, all of them are there. Wow. But I think it also works the other way, too, the non-virtuous ones. They also say, I think the Vaibhashika also say that like the non-virtuous mental factors can be together with our sense perceptions, you know, with your eye consciousness. Anger can be with your eye consciousness. But I think the upper schools wouldn't agree with that. Only conceptual minds would have anger and so on. I mean, otherwise... Yeah, big trouble. Next thing is just maybe it's a minor point, but it says in some Lowric texts, the definitions of doubt omit the phrase by its own power. And that means that this type of mind could include both the main minds and the mental factors together with doubt. And Lati Rinpoche comments that he actually prefers that definition. But then I was wondering if that could lead to debates, for example. Then somebody might say, okay, so then the feeling that accompanies doubt would also be doubt. And they probably have debates about that. But anyway, normally it's said that doubt is its own distinct mental factor, but it can color or flavor the whole mind to be doubt. Okay, so then there's three types of doubt. There's actually two different ways of dividing doubt into three. The first one is in terms of whether the correctness of it. So the first one is doubt tending towards the fact. For example, thinking, I wonder if my body is impermanent or permanent. It's probably impermanent. So the fact is, it is impermanent. So here you're having doubt, but you're leaning more in the direction of the correct conclusion. And the second one, doubt not tending towards the fact. So you're thinking the same thing, but thinking it's probably permanent. So you're leaning towards the wrong conclusion, the mistaken idea. And the third one is equal doubt, where you're not really leaning in either direction. Just equally, maybe it's permanent, maybe it's not, I don't know. You're not leaning in either direction. Another way of dividing doubt is into virtuous, non-virtuous, and neutral. So the first one is virtuous doubt, would be thinking, for example, I'm not sure if there's such a thing as enlightenment, but probably there is. So you're not really sure, you're in doubt about it, but you're leaning in the direction of accepting it. And it said, if you have this state of mind, and you don't encounter any hindering conditions, for example, somebody coming along and telling you there's no such thing as enlightenment and being really strong about that, that might shake you. So if you don't meet that kind of condition, then this kind of doubt will eventually turn into a correct assumption regarding the existence of enlightenment, where you're really kind of quite firm in believing in it. You don't yet have an inferential valid cognizer, but you're quite strong in accepting the existence of enlightenment. The second one is a non-virtuous doubt. So this would be to think, I'm not sure if there's such a thing as enlightenment. Probably not. So this could turn into a wrong consciousness where you think, there's no such thing as enlightenment. That's just a whole lot of rubbish. Unless you encounter positive conditions. For example, somebody coming along and giving you very convincing arguments that there is such a thing as enlightenment. And then it could turn into a virtuous doubt or even into a correct assumption. But otherwise you could end up in a wrong conception thinking there's no such thing as enlightenment. And then third is neutral doubt. examples are just like ordinary everyday kind of things. Will it rain today? Will it rain tomorrow or not? Will so-and-so come to class today? Did I put enough sugar in my tea? Should I go to bed right after class or should I do something else? So that kind of, you know, uncertainty. That's just neutral doubt. So we probably have a lot of doubts coming and going in our mind. So it's normally included in the six root afflictions in the Lamrim, which are ignorance, attachment, anger, pride, afflicted doubt, and wrong views. But in this case, doubt is the non-virtuous kind. Okay, not virtuous doubt or neutral doubt. It's the non-virtuous kind. For example, thinking there's probably no such thing as enlightenment. There's probably no such thing as karma. I can do whatever I want and nothing's going to happen. So that kind of doubt would be afflicted doubt. In the teachings on concentration, developing calm abiding concentration, doubt is one of the five hindrances. We have doubt. What am I doing here? This is a waste of time. Maybe I should get up and do something else. So if you have doubt about meditation, about your practice, about the teachings, then it causes the mind to be shaky and wavering rather than steady. But in general, doubt is not negative. In fact, it can even be positive or virtuous. The Dalai Lama often speaks about the importance of having doubt about teachings that we hear rather than blindly accepting them. So Aryadeva, in his text, the 400, says that just having a doubt about the true nature of things, i.e. emptiness, tears cyclic existence to shreds, something like that. So it's actually good to have, how do things really exist? Are they real as they appear or not? Just having that kind of doubt, it starts to shake the foundations of samsara. And also in the Ornament of Clear Realizations, the Abhisamayalankara by Maitreya, it speaks of two types of followers. One is called a follower of faith and a follower of reasoning. Follower of faith is someone who just, there's such a thing as enlightenment and I want to do it, I want to go for it. They don't really think about it, they just kind of blindly go along with it. But followers of reasoning are those who have doubt. Is there such a thing as enlightenment or not? Can I reach enlightenment or not? And they investigate, and they become really strong practitioners. So it's said that the second type, followers of reasoning, are said to be of sharper faculty. So it's not bad to have doubt, it's not wrong to have doubt, but we need to do something about it, not just get stuck in it. Because if we get stuck, it's like being in quick mud, you know. It's hard to progress, hard to move forward if you have doubt. It can be kind of immobilizing. So it's good to try to investigate on your own or go and talk to others. I find the more I study, the more I learn, the more my doubts get cleared away. Sometimes doubt is because you don't know enough, you haven't studied enough, you're not so knowledgeable. But also, not just learning, but also thinking, meditating, investigating things. Okay, we have one more, but this won't take too long. Number 7, wrong consciousness. And this is defined as a knower which is mistaken with regard to its object of engagement. So we did already talk about that above. So the main object that is being perceived or conceived or whatever, the main object of that mind. So if the mind is mistaken with regard to that object, then it's a wrong consciousness. So here's some examples. Wrong consciousnesses can be conceptual or non-conceptual. So examples of conceptual wrong consciousnesses, these would be conceptions that engage their object erroneously. For example, a conception, thinking that sound is permanent. A conception, thinking there is a substantially existent self, or a truly existent self, or an inherently existing self. A conception, thinking you're someone you're not, thinking you're the Dalai Lama. A conception, thinking the mirage on the surface of the desert is a lake. Okay, so, and again, you know, all of our disturbing emotions, our anger, anytime we have anger, anytime we have attachment, ignorance, of course, these are all examples of wrong conceptions. They're not seeing their object in a correct way, but in an erroneous way. And then examples of non-conceptual wrong consciousnesses. It could be sense or mental. So some examples of wrong consciousnesses that are sense perceptions, seeing a mirage as water, hearing an echo of your voice as another person's voice, feeling sensations of a phantom limb. And then an example of a wrong consciousness that's mental perception would be a dream consciousness that sees a dream object, for example, thinking there's a, seeing a tiger in your room as a real tiger. And then I had this discussion some years ago with Geshima Kelsang Wangmo. I asked her if a wrong consciousness can ever be useful. For example, we can learn from our dreams, right? Sometimes you can learn things from your dreams, as long as you don't take them too seriously, but something can be learned from them. In therapy, for example, therapists may use that. And also sometimes people use creative visualization to cure physical and psychological problems. You can visualize things that aren't really true, aren't really there, and that can be helpful for you dealing with problems. So her answer was yes. And she says, sometimes there's a distinction made between wrong consciousnesses that you deliberately make to arise. The example she gave was taking on the suffering of others. I mean, Tonglen meditation, right? We're visualizing that the suffering of others is coming in the form of smoke, and we're taking it in, and it's destroying our self-cherishing mind and so on. I mean, it's not really happening. Yeah? So we're just inventing this, creating this visualization. But it it has a very beneficial effect on our mind and our practice. It creates a lot of virtue. And then there's also, you know, wrong consciousnesses that just arise involuntarily. And she says, some scholars, I guess, say that wrong consciousness is only the latter, those that arise involuntarily, but not the former. And there's actually a discussion about this in the book, which you can read if you want to. Because there's this kind of meditation, just an example, where you visualize bones. I think like in the four mindfulnesses, you visualize everything turning into bones. And they actually say if you do that a lot, even with your eye consciousness, you just see bones everywhere. So it's quite strange. It's done for a purpose, of course, to overcome attachment. But so there's discussion. Is that a wrong consciousness? Because it's not really true. Not that everything everywhere is bones. So yeah, some say yes, it's wrong. Some say no, it's not wrong because you're doing it deliberately. You're deliberately cultivating this kind of mind, and it's done for a purpose. So it's not like just delusions that come up involuntarily and are harmful, not beneficial. Anyway, there's a whole discussion about that. And she also said, afflictive emotions like anger are wrong consciousnesses, but we can learn from them. Remember her saying, I learn a lot from my anger. And I agree. You know, if we don't just get caught up in the anger, but we can step back from it and look at it and analyze it and work with it and transform our mind into something else like compassion, patience, love, can be incredibly beneficial. So it all depends on what we do, how we use these wrong consciousnesses. They're not necessarily totally useless. Okay, so we've gone quickly through these seven types of awareness, and then I made this little chart. This is my own creation, and it may not be right. So if you see any mistake in it, then let me know. But I did this originally just for my own sake, because it's so complicated, all these different possibilities between the different minds. And if there's an X in any of these boxes, that only means that there could be some instances of that particular thing. For example, the first line is direct perceivers, and if you go across, right in the middle, there's incontrovertible and controvertible. So there's an X in both of those boxes, which means that some direct perceivers are incontrovertible. Some are controvertible. Some are prime or valid. Some are non-prime. Some are sense. Some are mental. So just it just gives the possibilities. And if there's a blank box, that means no way, never happens. I find these charts helpful. Something visual rather than, man, I don't think they did this in Tibet, you know? They must have had, well, they probably have very good powers of visualization, but to be able to figure all this out just in your mind.
I don't even quite know how to explore it, but in all the discussion of the inattentive awarenesses, not saying the long thing, but I don't think it ever occurred to me so much how much the mental consciousness and the sense consciousnesses are married in order to retain like the fact that the thing was seen. Like the memory is not in the eye consciousness. It's a totally conceptual awareness. So as we're training, practicing mindfulness, for example, or just trying to practice mindfulness of the breath, it's not just the sense consciousness that's present. You know, it's somehow the link between getting those two operating together has never been so clear to me as in that explanation.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying when we're watching the breath, then there needs to be also mental consciousness that, yeah.
Saying, Venerable Trini, that when you're doing breathing meditation, it's the sense consciousness that's feeling the sensation, but the mental consciousness that's using the mental factors to bring you back when your attention wanders?
Yes. that, and that to actually have attention, I have to bring the mental consciousness more closely to the sense consciousness. I mean, that's, they have to be working together. That's when I'm meditating.
Yeah, because I was thinking, like, we need to have introspection, that mental factor that is monitoring what's going on and able to recognize if the mind is on the object or if it's gone somewhere else, if it's awake or it's asleep. And I think introspection would have to be with mental consciousness, not with sense consciousness. So we definitely need. And mindfulness, too. I think also mindfulness is not a sensory consciousness. I think it's a mental factor, but I think it would be accompanying the mental consciousness. So, yeah, we do need to have, it probably alternates very quickly, sense and mental, back and forth. But yeah, if it was only sense, then I don't know if we could have mindfulness.
Because clearly there's an inattentive awareness about breathing. I'm breathing all day long. How much do I know?
You remember every single breath right. that you take.
But clearly there's no mental engagement with that.
Paying attention to our computers and conversations and so many other things, yeah.
Christina. Question online back from the very beginning of the class about the Buddha and having bodhicitta. So this person said that, I would think that the Buddha would have bodhicitta if we think of it as meaning the wish to benefit others. If the Buddha didn't have that, why would he be doing what they're doing?
I think the qualm is because bodhicitta is said to be the wish for enlightenment to benefit all living beings. So Buddha's already there. He's already enlightened. So how could he still have the wish for enlightenment? So those who say Buddha does have bodhicitta, they say, oh, well, even though he has already achieved enlightenment, he has the wish for enlightenment for others. He wants to bring all other beings to enlightenment. So I think that's where the doubt comes in. I mean, definitely the Buddha wants to benefit all sentient beings. He has that state of mind, but the wish for enlightenment, the wish to attain enlightenment, that's the problem for how a Buddha could have that. But to me it makes sense that, yeah, he wishes enlightenment for everyone else besides himself. Okay, so we've gone through these seven. We have all of these at varying times in our mind. And ideally, if we want to progress along the path, reach liberation, reach enlightenment, what we need to do is achieve valid cognizers, especially with regard to emptiness, the true nature of all things. And we first develop, well, we go from a wrong consciousness, you've probably heard this before, how right now we have wrong consciousness, thinking things are inherently existing. But then we start hearing teachings, we start having doubt. Well, yeah, maybe things aren't so solid and real as they appear. Keep thinking, meditating, and eventually we get to correct assumption, right? I really think things are empty of inherent existence, but it's not that strong. So we keep meditating and eventually get to an inferential valid cognizer with respect to emptiness. That's based on a reason. That's a very strong, very powerful experience of emptiness. It's still not the best. The best is the yogic direct perceiver of emptiness. So we need to keep meditating, and eventually that inference turns into a direct perception, a yogic direct perception of emptiness. So that's why it's helpful to know these different states of mind, because we need to progress through them to eventually free ourselves from the causes of suffering, the disturbing states of mind, and then progress further to enlightenment so we can help everyone else do the same. So thank you for giving me the chance to talk about this. It's helpful for me. I've studied this before, but you get a bit rusty on it. Oh, yeah.
Interested in what you just last said, and I'm wondering if in your reading or teachings you've heard or whatever, if the galupas have a, I mean, not one size fits all, but in general, when would a person, how far would a person want to get before they would, maybe in their studies, before they would, in this seven, list of seven here, before they would go off and try to develop shamatha? I asked Venerable Children that once, and she just, from her own thinking, thought, I think it'd be good if they had a correct assumption first. But I'm wondering if this is ever spoken about. Maybe it's not.
You mean with regard to emptiness?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, what some people can go and work on getting concentration, but they don't actually have the philosophical understanding of how to meditate on emptiness, so they wouldn't really be able to progress in that aspect of it. But then also you need a powerful mind actually to even, I think, have an inference. You know what I mean? And concentration makes your mind more powerful. So I just wonder if this is ever spoken about that you've heard of. Maybe not.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's different ways for different people. I mean, I've heard that, like, even in the monasteries, when the monks are in the monasteries and studying, they can sometimes get these realizations. Sometimes on the debating ground or sitting in a puja, they can get a realization of emptiness, inferential realization of emptiness. Sometimes also calm abiding. I think to recall, like with Geshe Rabten, they talk about him having super powerful concentration even when he was in the monastery. So you don't necessarily have to go off somewhere else, like in retreat situations, to get these realizations. It's possible to happen even in a monastic situation. And as to which one you develop first, probably in a monastery, in that kind of situation, it would be easier to get the inferential realization of emptiness first. Harder to have calm abiding. But I've also heard the Dalai Lama say, you know, there's a real lack of people engaging in calm abiding practice, calm abiding retreat, and he wants that to change. And he suggested that they open like a center where people can go and really work on that. So I haven't really heard specific advice about which you do first and